From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Jeffrey Toobin's latest book is about the 1974 kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. It's a sensational story, so you probably know a lot of the basics, but Toobin connects these crimes, the kidnapping, the bank robberies, the shootings, to a very particular time where the hopefulness of the 60s had given way to the cynicism of the 70s. In fact, Toobin says Patricia Hearst's kidnapping provided hints of what America would become, the future of the media, the culture of celebrity. This was the year Nixon resigned. There was violence in the streets, in the prisons. The country, he says, was going through a collective nervous breakdown. But above all, he says in his book, this is the story of the kidnapping of a single young woman. And Toobin is joining us today to take us through it after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Broadway at the Eccles, presenting the Broadway musical The Book of Mormon, coming to the Eccles Theater in Salt Lake from August 1st through 20th. Tickets and information are at broadwayattheeccles.com or 801-355-ARTS. All American!
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. There was a lot going on in 1974. Watergate was raging. The president would resign in the summer. The economy was tanking. There was an energy crisis with long gas lines. The Yom Kippur War had started. And at the same time, the country was paying attention to the story of the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. As Jeffrey Toobin explains it in his latest book, the kidnapping was so sensational and so aberrational that it existed apart from the other conflicts that were convulsing the country. Toobin's book is about the crazy story of Patricia Hearst and the ongoing question of how or why she ended up joining this ragged group of urban guerrillas that had taken her in February of 74. But he sets the story, the kidnapping, the crimes, the trial, all of that in the backdrop of a particular time, the 70s. He's joining us today to talk about it. His book is called American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker, senior legal analyst for CNN. His books have looked at the Supreme Court, the presidency, the trial of O.J. Simpson. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Jeffrey Toobin, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug.
Well, I guess we should begin with the thing that got you interested in this story. As I understand it, you were really interested in the kind of countercultural urban guerrilla movements. I mean, that was your way in some way to the story?
Well, it was. It wasn't through Patty Hearst. It was through the people who kidnapped her. I did a story for The New Yorker about 3 years ago about a gang that took over a jail in Baltimore. And the gang was called the Black Guerrilla Family. And I got interested in the history of the Black Guerrilla Family, which was founded in the early 1970s in Soledad Prison in California by a famous prisoner named George Jackson.
Yeah.
And that led me to sort of go back to the 70s and see what was going on in that period because, you know, I was alive, but I was just a kid, so I don't have any real firsthand memories.
Yeah.
But I always kind of assumed that the 60s were the time in the United States when there was chaos and tumult and assassinations. But what I learned in my reporting was that the 70s, in many respects, were worse and crazier than the 60s. And that's really the backdrop for the Patty Hearst kidnapping.
I was surprised by the level of violence going on and the number of bombings.
Astonishing. I mean, I still can't get over this number. More than 1,000 bombings a year. Think about that in the United States. 1,000 political bombings a year. Now, most of them were not fatal. Many of them were small. But
yeah,
still, you know, just think about how the press today would react to one bombing, and there were 1,000. That's really tells you a story about what the country was like. But it's only the beginning. There were 2 hijackings of airplanes a month. There were serial killers on the loose in San Francisco. And as you mentioned earlier, there was Watergate. There was the energy crisis. I mean, it was really a dark time in the United States.
And you've got all these sort of countercultural warriors from these different groups who are springing up, the Weathermen, the Black Panthers. We'll talk about the SLA, obviously, as we go. Is it cynicism? Is it just hopelessness that's sort of driving a lot of this?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Once Richard Nixon ended the draft, he didn't end the Vietnam War, but he ended the draft, that led a lot of the sort of casually involved protesters to melt away. They were not altruistic enough to care that much about the war since they were not threatened with being drafted. So you had more of a hardcore who were involved in the counterculture, especially in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
In addition, you had really violent revolutionary groups springing up around the world at this time. You had the Tupamaros in Uruguay. You had the Red Brigades in Italy, the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany. And a small group of Americans wanted to emulate those radical and terroristic organizations. And that really was the combination of factors that led to the birth of the SLA.
Yeah. We'll come back to that because I want to work through some of the ideas seemed to inform this haphazard group. It's hard to say anything was coherent, but there were things, and we'll come back to that. But I wanted to ask you about something you say very early in the book, and I sort of mentioned it earlier in the introduction, that this story of the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst, this you say it's kind of a trailer for the modern world. Culture of celebrity, criminal justice, even sports. It's sort of giving us a sense, a taste of what's to come.
It is. You know, I spent a lot of time this year thinking about O.J. Simpson, even though my book about him came out 20 years ago because of the FX miniseries based on my book and the ESPN documentary, multi-part documentary that I was interviewed for. And there's a kind of a neat symmetry to the to 40 years ago was Patty Hearst, 20 years ago was OJ, and here we are today. And you see the evolution of certain parts of our society very clearly. You know, media attention. One of the things you always saw from the contemporary coverage of Patty Hearst was that people said, "Oh my gosh, it was covered nonstop. It was dominated the news media." And what was the example of that? Well, they say she was on the cover of Newsweek seven times.
Right.
And today, you know, people are going to say, "Well, you know, what's Newsweek and what's a cover?"
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, it was a just much smaller media universe. You had three half-hour evening news shows. You had the Today Show, but Good Morning America didn't even start till 1975. People Magazine started in 1974. You know, the interest in celebrity and the sort of nonstop coverage what was really only in an inchoate early stage in 74, whereas when it comes to O.J. Simpson 20 years later, you have cable news. Mm-hmm. So you had CNN and Court TV, not yet Fox and not yet MSNBC. But, of course, you had no internet and no social media. So you see the gradual expansion of news media ubiquity that is part of this story, but again, only one part.
Something else struck me, hadn't occurred to me. This was the first time in the country's history there had been a political kidnapping.
And it remains the only political kidnapping. And I guess that's something we can all be grateful for. But again, this was an example of how the SLA imitated these radical groups in other countries because they had engaged in kidnapping and, in fact, kidnapping and murder. Aldo Moro, the former prime minister of Italy, was kidnapped and murdered by the Red Brigades. The Tupamaros in Uruguay, who were very much the most explicit model for the SLA, kidnapped newspaper editors, which, you know, again, led to the interest in the Hearst family. But it was not something that has ever been a part of American life, we can all be grateful to say. I mean, there have been kidnappings, but exclusively just for money, like Lindbergh and, of course, many less celebrated ones. But in terms of a kidnapping with political demands, the list begins and ends with Patty Hearst.
Yeah. I think it would be easy to see the Symbionese Liberation Army as a kind of hapless group of kind of clueless posers. And in some ways, that was probably true. We'll talk about that. But
I would be, for example, someone who might see them that way.
Yeah.
But there is something more to them.
Yeah. Right. And I wanted to ask you about that because they were, as you say in the book, more complex than any stereotype. They were kind of this tribe, but I guess to the theme that you're talking about in terms of time, they were a product of this place and of this time.
They were, and they left behind, you know, a series of very long and almost entirely unreadable communiques that describe their political philosophy. And, you know, it was a kind of pigeon Marxism, but it was Marxist and it was Maoist and it was revolutionary. They certainly didn't have a program that they were thinking of implementing. I mean, they certainly weren't. You know, this was not the James Madison of Berkeley, California. But they did. They were inspired by something called the FOCO theory, F-O-C-O, which was a then fashionable theorist named René Debray advocated, which was the idea that, you know, small revolutionary groups would inspire the larger population. Of course, they didn't in the United States or anywhere else. And the other thing that was a real influence, and this was quite specific, you know, several of the SLA people came from the Indiana University Theater Program.
Right.
And that was the time where there was guerrilla theater popular in the country, which was theater with explicitly political goals. And if you look at how the SLA behaved, they were very interested in making a splash, in getting attention, in sort of shocking the world. That was a kind of politics in and of itself, and there was an ideology of sorts behind it.
You write about – it seems – and this seems like a theme for what happens with Patricia Hearst in some way. The SLA – so they have some models, some sort of rough models for what they're trying to do. But as you say, as they're sort of driving back from the kidnapping, you say their unofficial motto might well have been, "What now?" And it seems like that's a theme for what happens to them, that they sort of just act based on circumstance, that there wasn't really a coherent sense of what they were going to do necessarily.
Absolutely. I mean, think about kidnapping someone without knowing what your ransom demand was. I mean, it's just lunacy, you know, and yet that was the situation. Yet it was their interest in showmanship and guerrilla theater that led them to the really remarkable and in some ways sort of almost admirable attempt to feed the poor of California rather than seek any money for themselves.
The theatrical part of this story I wanted to ask you about, because you say that in some ways it wasn't – the SLA wasn't really a vehicle for political change. It was just kind of an instrument for getting attention for its own sake. And you get a sense from time to time as you sort of break down some of the fascinating characters in the SLA, and there weren't that many, that they cared more about personal things than they cared about political change. I mean, they had that at their core in some ways. That did draw them together. But it was also such a strange story about political relationships and sexual relationships. I mean, it was really intimate in that way too.
It was. I mean, this was the heyday between the arrival of the birth control pill and the arrival of AIDS.
Yeah.
So it was a time of sexual abandon in certain quarters, and the SLA certainly reflected that. There was also, you know, there was an interracial level of excitement there. You know, to the extent people remember the Symbionese Liberation Army at all, they think of it as a black revolutionary group. Well, there was exactly one African American right. in the SLA, Donald DeFries, who in the typical dramatic fashion of the SLA called himself General Field Marshal Sin Q.
Yeah.
And his relationships with the white women who were mostly constituted the group,
right.
that was, you know, I think part of the excitement on both sides. That I don't think, you know, that was not a program for change that they were part of. It was just an example of how these sorts of things were in the air.
A veritable counterculture Updike novel. Is how you describe it.
That's right. I say that. Gosh, you read it carefully. I'm so pleased that quote has not been read back to me, and I was rather fond of that.
Thank yeah, you. Good job. Well, we'll get back to some of these personal relationships. Let's talk about where Patricia Hearst is. She comes to be known as Patty. Everyone sort of says that she hated Patty. Didn't she?
Yeah, I know. It's funny, and to this day, I actually had an argument with my editor about that because, as you know, having read the book, I refer to her throughout the book as Patricia,
yeah.
As she always wants to be known. But her father, whom she adored, held many press conferences and always referred to her as Patty. Thus, the news media and everyone since has called her Patty. And my editor at Doubleday, I originally put the name Patricia Hearst in the subtitle, and she said, no, you can't put Patricia Hearst. Everybody knows her as Patty Hearst. I said, no, but that's not fair.
Yeah.
And he said, and so I lost that argument. And so the subtitle of the book, you know, refers to Patty Hearst. But, you know, I do think that
But it's in red lettering. Jeffrey, maybe you got that.
Yeah. No, the publisher's the boss.
Right.
But I do think it is indicative of a larger theme in the book, which is, first of all, that Patty Hearst, when she was arrested, was 19 years old.
Yeah.
And I don't think I am going out on a limb to say 19 is young.
Right.
And she was very much an unformed person. And she was, at that moment, particularly unsettled because she was living with her fiancé, Stephen Weed, mm-hmm. who she increasingly couldn't stand.
Yeah.
At the same time, she was estranged from her mother, who was a very conservative woman and disapproved of her living in sin, as the phrase went in those days, mm-hmm. with Stephen Weed. So she was sort of whipsawed between these two principal forces in her life and thus uniquely susceptible, I think,
yeah.
to a very different direction in her life.
So interesting. She and Stephen Weed have settled into, as you sort of refer to it, as this kind of this middle-aged existence. They didn't go out much. She had lapsed into the life of a proto-housewife, is how you put it. And so she's 19, as you say. She's still unformed. She's pretty restless. Turns out she's kind of rambunctious. I get a sense that she was kind of bored, that even though this was horrific, that she finds a connection with these people that's starting to give her, if not some purpose, at least something interesting in her life.
Absolutely. And you know, this case is very much associated with certain buzzwords like Stockholm Syndrome and brainwashing. And I think it's important to remember that those are journalistic terms. They're not medical terms. Yeah. And while I discuss them in the book, I try to focus rather on the specifics of Patty's situation rather than what label you apply to them. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, the kidnapping was horrifying, terrifying, a terrible, terrible ordeal for Patricia. But once she settled in with the SLA, they started to talk to her. And one of them in particular, Willie Wolfe, who came from a background somewhat similar to Patricia's own. He was a physician's son. He'd gone to prep school. He'd gone to Berkeley. He was an upper middle class kid. And the relationship between Willie Wolfe and Patty Hearst is one of the central issues and controversies of the book, but it also illustrates just how she could become – she could come to feel welcome and part of the group in relatively short order.
We'll get back to this a little bit later in the program, but it does give you the sense of how complicated it would be just for the normal person to kind of adjudicate what sort of accountability she holds because of the trauma of it, because of her age. We'll come back to that, but I'm sure you must have felt conflicted about deciding where to come down on whether – on certain aspects of her accountability in all of this.
Very, very much so. But it's the principal fascination of the story and of my book. I think one reason people are still so fascinated by the Patty Hearst kidnapping is because there is that central mystery. What was her real motivation over the year and a half that she was on the run with the SLA? What does it mean? I mean, you know, and I'm not trying to inflate this beyond its own importance, but it really goes to the questions of what we mean by free will and why we do what we do. Because, you know, this was terrible, this kidnapping. It was terrifying. These were bad people in most every respect. But at the same time, when you look at Patricia's behavior over a long time, a year and a half, it looks very much to me like voluntary behavior when you have many opportunities to escape and you commit an astonishing series of crimes.
Yeah.
I think the issue of personal responsibility comes to the fore.
I was trying to make a running list of all of the interesting people who show up in this story. It's kind of a Forrest Gump sort of moment, like Jane Pauley and Bill Walton and Errol Morris and Kevin Kline, Judge Ito from the O.J. Simpson trial. Kind of a weird convergence of different people at different moments in this story.
I have to confess that I loved putting all those goofy names in there.
Yeah.
I looked for these strange connections. Lance Ito, who was around Berkeley at this time, and I hasten to add, not a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army. Jane Pauley, who was at Indiana University and knew a couple of the people who wound up being in the group. Kevin Kline, the actor, also in Indiana at the time. Bill Walton, the basketball player who was close friends with Jack Scott, who sheltered the SLA when they were on the run. Partly I put those names in just because it's fun and it's interesting, but also because it just shows that that this world – was one that evolved into our own, and some of the cast of characters wound up being the same.
Jeffrey Toobin is with us. His book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer and legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin is joining us to talk about his latest book. It's called American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. I wanted to go back a little bit and talk some more about the things that are motivating the Symbionese Liberation Army. And could we just put aside this question? What the hell does Symbionese mean?
Yes. Well, I people keep asking me, like, where was this country, Symbia? And there's no such country as Symbia. Donald DeFries, the escaped prisoner who started the SLA, you know, he knew the word symbiosis, the, you know, sort of working together, and he made it into an adjective. And he added liberation, even though they didn't liberate anything or anyone, and he called it an army, even though at its peak the group had about a dozen people. So I think of the name as triply misleading, but it has certainly survived into history.
There's that seven-headed cobra that they use as the symbol,
right,
which is that gives us that kind of iconic photo of Patricia standing in front of it.
Right. And, and you know, again, it comes out of the you know, the certain parts of the civil rights movement. I mean, they pick and choose. They pick and chose among, you know, various then active crusades. There are seven values in Kwanzaa, the African American holiday. Those seven values are reflected in the seven heads of the cobra. So they like that sort of symbolism, but that's what passed for a program or an idea in their world.
It is interesting also how, if you really go back and get a sense of what was motivating them, there was a real concern for or the real issue of criminal justice. I mean, we have to go back to the Vacaville prison, which was kind of the link that you say connected the kidnappers.
Right. And one of the things that I thought was interesting and that I didn't know is that for a lot of people in the counterculture, the prisons were seen as a place where revolution could be made, that there was this sense that every prisoner was a political prisoner. And this was not long after the Attica riots in New York, where you know the thought of prisoners as political rebels was very much in the air. And it was these students and recently ex-students who went to Vacaville, which was not far from Berkeley, and that's where they met Donald DeFries, and that's where they started sort of plotting and conspiring together. That was the basis of the SLA, this alliance between the counterculture and prisoners, even though, as I said, it was just one prisoner.
Yeah.
And this idea that prisoners had unique insight and value as prospective revolutionaries.
DeFries considers himself sort of a leader of African Americans, but he was the only, as you say, black man in the SLA. And there's this kind of comical moment when I think it's Angela Atwood is reading one of these communiques that they give to a radio station and mimicking the voice of a African American woman.
Right. I mean, you know, it's one of the many areas where it is tempting, and I certainly give into this temptation myself. On occasion, to find the SLA comic and ridiculous,
yeah.
Because they did a lot of comic and ridiculous things. The problem is they also killed two people,
right.
And I always try to keep that in mind before I find them too funny.
Yeah, let's talk about one of those people they kill, because there are these moments in the story that propel it forward to a kind of tragic climax, and one of them is in the fall of 1973. This was before the kidnapping, of course, and a man named Marcus Foster, charismatic black man. He's the superintendent of Oakland's school system, and he kind of becomes the first real target of the SLA.
He does. Donald DeFries, for reasons that remain mysterious to me, becomes obsessed with Marcus Foster.
Yeah.
At this point, DeFries, he'd been transferred from Vacaville to Soledad Prison, from which he escaped. He then tracked down the people who had been visiting him at Vacaville, these students, and lived in seclusion with them. There, he became obsessed with Foster, who was doing, you know, a difficult job well, as far as I can tell, and somehow was persuaded, DeFries was, that Foster was somehow some sort of traitor to the race, and wound up with two of the two women he was living with, assassinating Marcus Foster in cold blood,
yeah.
Which a crime so incomprehensible and horrific that even the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers denounced it, because even they recognized that Foster was hardly an enemy of African Americans. But that it was that crime which attracted the Indiana University contingent to join the SLA, and it was that crime, the arrest of two of the figures, that was one of the precipitating factors 2 months later that led them to kidnap Patty Hearst.
Yeah. And it's interesting, DeFries and others are really taken aback by the outrage because they figured that this would be an event and people would rally around them. I don't know. That seems illogical. But I guess they figured the left would sort of come with them. But the country's outraged, and it makes DeVries have to kind of rethink the way forward. He was really shocked by the reaction of this killing.
He was shocked, but I think it's indicative of how clueless and sinister DeVries was, that he could even conceive that assassinating an African-American school superintendent in a poor city would somehow rally people to his side. It did lead them to dial back, if that's the right word, from murder to kidnapping.
Yeah.
And which I guess we can be grateful for, but mostly it's indicative of how completely out of touch they were with what people in the real world thought about their tactics.
How did they choose Patricia Hearst? They made a list. She wasn't the only one on it, though.
By no means. There was a list of prominent people in the Bay Area. The Indiana contingent arrived and said, you know, this mere murder thing isn't working out so well. Let's make a splash with a kidnapping. So they started to get a list together of basically corporate executives in the Bay Area. But then just by coincidence in the San Francisco Examiner, which was the Hearst paper at the time, there was an engagement announcement of Patricia Hearst and Stephen Weed, and in the fourth paragraph it said that she was an undergraduate at Berkeley. Emily Harris, who was one of the Indiana immigrants, was working at Berkeley at the time as a secretary, and she knew in that more innocent era there was this public book, this big leather book, where you could look up the home address of any Berkeley student. So her husband, Bill Harris, went and looked up Patricia Hearst's home address, and they saw 2603 Benvenue, apartment 4 in Berkeley. And that led them to start staking her out and seeing her very quiet, predictable life, which led them to conclude correctly that if they knocked on her door on 9:30 on a Monday night, they could find her at home.
At some point before the kidnapping, though, the group moves to a suburb of San Francisco, a place called Concord, and they can kind of spread out a little bit more. And you mentioned the kind of culture. There's this sort of faux military behavior they engage in, where they're rehearsing these sort of violent encounters. Talk a little bit about what goes on there in that house in Concord.
Well, that was always a big part of their theatrics, that they styled themselves an army, as the SLA, you know, in their title suggested, and they were preparing for battle, and they bought an enormous number of weapons. They had a tremendous number of rounds of ammunition. Two of them, one of their original members, Joe Ramiro, had been a Vietnam veteran where he did a lot of horrific fighting, and he was sort of the lead trainer in military matters for them. And in that house in Concord, they built this tremendous arsenal of weapons that, again, it was never quite clear how they were going to use it, but the idea was an army needed weapons, and they did drills and practice for guerrilla warfare that they thought they might be participating in.
And there's another crucial thing that happens. It sort of gets the SLA to this point of no return. Two of their members are arrested. And despite all this planning for confrontation, they kind of panic and they flee. And they try to burn the place to the ground, but of course, they're inept at doing that. That doesn't work. And so basically the police are able to come into this place that has all of this cache of weapons and information. And I guess what? Basically their cover is blown at this point.
Right. After Joe Ramiro, who I mentioned, the sort of quartermaster and trainer of the group, and Russ Little, who were involved in the assassination of Marcus Foster, though not the trigger men.
Right.
They were arrested sort of coincidentally by an alert police officer in Concord. The SLA tried to burn down the house, but they forgot to open the windows, so there was no oxygen for the fire to really take off. So the police knew that this was the SLA safe house, and that meant at that point, which was January of 1974, that they knew exactly who they were because they had fingerprints. And that led Donald DeFries and it was really just eight people at that point to go underground. And that's where they made the plan to kidnap Patty Hearst the next month.
One thing we should mention, this kind of stunned me. So I guess it's the Concord Police Department that goes through this safe house. And law enforcement anyway, they find this list of potential kidnap victims and they amazingly don't warn any of them.
No, it's this is something that Patty Hearst and her family was deeply bitter about, that this list of names, none of the people on it was warned. I think it is mostly evidence of a haphazard police investigation, which certainly continued throughout this story, but also I think it's indicative of how no one even conceived that a political kidnapping could take place in the United States. It was also outside the realm of possibility that the police just didn't take it seriously. And, you know, that was obviously a mistake. But I do think, you know, the unprecedented nature of what the SLA did here is, you know, worthy of at least some consideration.
One of the extraordinary parts of the story is as you say, their first sort of ransom note doesn't actually contain a ransom. It's just basically a press release. But one of the things they eventually come up with, and this is a really fascinating part of the story, is this demand that Patricia Hearst's father and, you know, the fortune of the Hearst family feeds the poor. And now let's talk about it. The initial demand is fascinating because it's really detailed and, as you put it in the book, completely insane.
Well, basically, the original demand was that they feed anyone in the country, in the state of California, on welfare, ex-convicts, on Social Security. I mean, it would have amounted to millions and millions of people and thus many, many, many more millions of dollars, which Randy Hearst, her father, simply didn't have. Yeah. You know, another part of the story is that, you know, Randy Hearst was somewhat less wealthy than the Hearsts, than the SLA supposed. William Randolph Hearst, the great publisher, recognized that his four sons were drunks and ne'er-do-wells and structured his will so that they would really never have access to the core assets of the Hearst Corporation, so that they were basically kept on an allowance. You know, they had access to the Hearst mansion at San Simeon. And they had access to a lot of luxury, but in terms of actual dollars, they didn't have that many. So Randy Hearst was in the position of kind of negotiating with the SLA about how much money he could put up, and that was one of the things that alienated Patricia, who didn't know anything about the family finances. She thought that Randy was trying to sort of nickel and dime her at this moment of life and death, when in fact the SLA's demands were so crazy and outlandish that there really was no money to fund them.
Yeah. Well, eventually they do go through this people in need program where they actually feed people. At first it's disastrous, but they do end up actually feeding people. Which is interesting. Because – and this is one of the interesting parts of the story, I thought, for me, was just how, as you put it in the book, this experience turned out to be kind of transformational for Patricia's father. And it's nice to see that you kind of let him off the hook in some ways. I mean –
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I am pleased to say that I worked on this O.J. Simpson miniseries. The same screenwriters who wrote most of the O.J. series are working on a screenplay based on this book. And I was talking to them, and they say, you know, we love Randy Hearst. He's the only character in this story we all love, because he's sort of this you know, a little bit of a clueless rich guy who doesn't really work very hard, who likes to drink red wine and go duck hunting. But he really does love his daughter, and he makes a genuine effort to understand what was motivating her kidnappers, and he becomes kind of an explorer in the world of the counterculture. And he doesn't become sympathetic, but he does really try to understand, and he really does try like hell to get his daughter free.
Yeah. Before we head to a break, I wanted to mention just another strange moment of convergence in this story. It happens during this feeding program. Reverend Jim Jones shows up and demands to run the operation. This is Jim Jones of the People's Temple. Crazy.
This is the craziness of San Francisco at this time. It was the time of Jim Jones and the People's Temple. You know, it was the time of the Zodiac Killer and the Zebra Killers and you know, this maelstrom of violence. You know, I grew up in thinking about San Francisco as this glamorous, wealthy, high-tech city. And what was so illuminating for me is that San Francisco was so dirty and dangerous in the 70s that Warner Brothers made Dirty Harry, Clint Eastwood's famous detective, a San Francisco detective because they wanted him in the most dangerous place in America.
Jeffrey Toobin is with us. His book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back with Jeffrey Toobin. We're talking about his book, American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. First, you describe the SLA's treatment of Patricia Hearst as this combination of fear and comfort, which may give us some clues as to whether Patricia had been, you know, indoctrinated. I know you don't like the word brainwashed. But you say that the SLA really was too chaotic, too incoherent, too muddled to have brainwashed Patricia.
Without question. I mean, to the extent brainwashing exists at all, it is something that's associated with the Korean War, where there were American pilots who were shot down and basically indoctrinated by the North Koreans with the idea that Americans had committed war crimes, and several came out and said that. But it was very much an intentional, manipulation of these captives. The SLA had no such plan, but what they did have was their personalities, and they varied actually. Some of them were aggressive. DeFries was aggressive with Patricia, but some of them were sort of spacey counterculture types. Yeah. Angela Atwood, the actress, you know, was talking to Patricia about her love life, and Willie Wolfe was kind of a soft smoking, what we'd call geek today.
Yeah.
And they do appear to have hit it off, and it is not surprising to me. You know, people talk about brainwashing. I mean, to me, the most clear and believable explanation of what went on with Patricia is that she behaved rationally.
Right.
She responded rationally to the circumstances she was faced with, being told that her father was not putting up the money that he should have, that the FBI was getting ready to kill them all. That might well lead a 19 or 20-year-old to say, you know what, I'm on your side.
Willie Wolfe would sit outside of Patricia's closet. She was kept in a closet at first, and read to her this Maoist and Marxist literature. And the question, of course, comes up, and you sort of refer to it, whether or not – clearly they had sex. But the question was, you know, how much of that was coerced? How much of this was – how much consent could she give? And it's hard to imagine how a woman – could have consented to sex when she was first being held against her will. She was in a closet. She was blindfolded. So everyone agrees at first it maybe wasn't consensual, but you know, what sense do you make of this particular relationship?
Well, I, again, this is an example of how much society has changed. In those days, you couldn't get a conviction for rape unless you could prove that the person was physically forced to have sex. I mean, there was no, you know, it had to be like an actual physical force. Now, of course, we have very different ideas about, you know, the nature of consent, that, you know, people can be coerced through words as well as through, actual physical violence. And I don't think there is anyone who would say that a woman, a blindfolded woman, even if she said she consented, a kidnap victim, could actually consent to sex. But when you look at Patricia's subsequent behavior with Willie Wolfe and throughout, you know, then later with others, I think the story gets a lot more complicated. And the idea that her relationship with Willie Wolfe was entirely coerced becomes a lot less tenable. Yeah. And that's one of the areas in the story, frankly, where I try to tread the most carefully, because I have been well trained, I hope, in modern understandings of sexual violence, and so that. But it is a key part of the story, and like a lot of real life, it's complicated.
Yeah. In fact, one of the turning points in the case, and I'm not sure how much we should talk about this. I don't want to give too much away. But does one of the turning points in her trial does relate to her connection with Willie Wolfe?
Absolutely. And this is really, a Perry Mason moment in her trial. I mean, just to fast forward to the time she's on trial for the first bank robbery, her defense is I was coerced and I was in fear for my life. And that's why I agreed to participate in the bank robbery. The prosecutors were always looking for ways to refute that, to show that she was voluntarily participating. Well, during the trial, Bill and Emily Harris, who were her comrades on the run for many years, gave an interview that said where they were asked the same question: how can you prove that Patricia really voluntarily, really wanted to be in a relationship with Willie Wolfe? And they said, look, Patricia carried with her at all times a little charm, a Mexican charm called an Olmec monkey that Willie gave her. Mm-hmm. And Willie died with one around his neck. Why would Patricia carry around this charm if she hated Willie Wolfe? So the prosecutors read that. They go into their evidence locker. They empty the purse that Patricia is arrested with. And they see she was carrying the Olmec monkey. And there's a young paralegal, almost exactly Patricia's age, on the prosecution team. And she says, look, no woman would carry around the charm that a rapist gave her. This is indicative of something of real affection between the two. And very late in the trial, the prosecutors decided to introduce the evidence of the Olmec monkey, the two Olmec monkeys, one that Willie Wolfe had at his death, the other Patricia had. And that had a big impact on the jury. The jury thought, well, you know, maybe that's a good point, that actually you wouldn't carry around a charm of someone whom you hated. I leave your listeners to decide whether that's persuasive or not, but the jurors were interested.
Yeah, she was convicted.
Yes.
Sentenced to 7 years. And of course, what's fascinating is she gets her sentence commuted by one president and then pardoned by another. And here's what you write at the end of the book. You say, rarely have the benefits of wealth, power, and renown been as clear as they were in the aftermath of Patricia Hearst's conviction. Would you say something about that?
Well, you know, I don't have a, you know, correct sentence in mind. I do think Patricia was guilty of this and other crimes. But I generally think that people in the United States are sentenced to too long in prison. But the one thing everybody should agree on is that like criminals should be sentenced to like amounts of time. And the prisons are full of people who are misguided and make mistakes and fall in with a bad crowd, and none of them get a presidential commutation. And even fewer of them also get a pardon. Patricia Hearst is the only person in American history, in modern American history, to receive a commutation from one president and a pardon from another. And the only explanation for that, in my view, is that she benefited from the wealth and privilege and fame of the Hearst family and was able to organize campaigns that persuaded both Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton to give her those gifts.
So the 80s come, the counterculture sort of fades away. The term becomes obsolete, as you say. And Patricia, eventually she writes a book in 1982, or a ghostwriter wrote the book. She talks to a ghostwriter called Every Secret Things. It's one of the things you sort of had to go by. I'm guessing, what did you gather from that book? I mean, she portrays herself as a helpless victim, which she wasn't clearly all the time. She did some interviews with friendly journalists, or as you say, underinformed journalists. She didn't ultimately talk to you. I mean, what can you gather from what Patricia Hearst these days or even then says about her experience?
Well, her book, which is actually quite interesting, is an elaboration of her testimony at the trial,
right,
which was, I was forced to do everything. I had no free will. I had no choice but to participate in these crimes. The larger interest of Patricia Hearst, I think, as a sociological phenomenon is you see that she came into her genetic destiny. She, notwithstanding this bizarre year and a half interlude, became a rich lady in the suburbs.
Yeah.
She became a sort of socialite, a sometime actress, but basically she turned into her mother, which is the fate of all of us, I think. And and that to me was at once surprising and utterly unsurprising. And that seemed to me a sort of fitting conclusion that, you know, we all are fated to return to our parents' lives for better or for worse.
It's Jeffrey Toobin. His book is American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Jeffrey, thanks very much for the time.
Doug, it was great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.